Good evening, everyone. In an effort to get started on time, we're going to get things going. My name is Rich DeClue. I'm the replacement today. I'm from St. Louis University. I'm a second-year doctoral student in epidemiology. So this session is the aging epidemic, HIV, in older adults. Our first speaker today is Dr. Mozak. She's from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee in the Department of Psychology, and she also leads the Patient Advocacy and Research Lab. The title of her presentation is Nobody Should Die from HIV, Patient and Provider Perspectives on Death and the Relevance of Early End-of-Life Care Decision-Making in the Context of HIV. So let's welcome her.
Hello, thank you. I don't have any relationships to disclose, but I do have a brief disclaimer, which is, this session is on HIV and aging, and to the extent that one might equate end-of-life care decision-making with aging, then I'm in the right place. But what I'm going to be arguing here in just a short while is that we need to be talking about end-of-life care decision-making much earlier, both in the course of the disease and in a person's life in terms of chronology than we do. So that's my disclaimer. So we live in what has been referred to as a paradox of HIV, paradox of AIDS medicine. As you well know, within the past 20 years, we've had great treatment advances, but unfortunately, still half of all people living with HIV die of AIDS defining illnesses in the U.S. And so what I believe has happened is palliative care, and specifically end-of-life care planning, has taken a back seat in terms of our focus for the healthcare among people with HIV. Palliative care provides patients and their families with support. Specifically, it provides patients with chronic illness the medical management in terms of reducing pain and symptoms. It can be administered at any point in patient's course of illness, but is specifically relevant at the end of life. Researchers have conducted studies in terms of HIV end of life care decision making among physicians and patients and their families. In other diseases, but we haven't seen this in terms of HIV. And again, I argue that I believe this is a consequence of this paradox of AIDS medicine. So we know that palliative care can be used to medically manage painful symptoms and the worsening physical health functioning that occurs at the end of life. But there's also really important benefits to patients and their family members by simply having the discussion. Such discussions have been shown to improve not only end-of-life care, but patient and family healthcare satisfaction. Having the discussions has been associated with reduced anxiety, depression, and stress among the survivors compared to those families and patients who have not had the discussion. But unfortunately, as you may or may not know, people with HIV are actually less likely to have these discussions with their healthcare providers than people with other life-threatening diseases. So given our nascent understanding of these issues, we wanted to investigate how HIV-positive patients and infectious disease healthcare providers think about death, dying, and end-of-life care planning, and the manner by which patients and providers share or diverge in their perspectives on these topics. Our study was part of a broader project in which we interviewed patients and providers in 2005 about their experiences with collaborative healthcare decision making. For that project, we conducted semi-structured qualitative interviews with providers and patients separately. For the current study, we used data related to expectations about death and dying within the context of HIV, broad conceptualizations of end-of-life care, and conversations they had had related to end-of-life care and end-of-life care decision-making. We attempted to elicit both positive and negative experiences through the use of detailed prompts. And then at the conclusion of each interview, we gathered demographic data. We used a secondary comparative analytic method to compare the data between these two groups of individuals. We interviewed 11 providers. It was a relatively diverse sample with respect to gender and age, as well as educational background, practice history, and context. Providers were mostly white, and no one identified themselves as being HIV positive. For this study, we used data from 42 patient interviews. About two-thirds of the sample was male, and all but a few participants self-identified as African-American or black. They represented diverse educational backgrounds and length of time with HIV. About a quarter of the sample reported having an AIDS diagnosis at the time of the interview. Our analyses revealed key differences with respect to philosophical thinking about death, dying, and end-of-life care in the context of HIV. Specifically, patients and providers imparted different accounts of what end-of-life means, what end-of-life care means, and the degree to which they believe that living a long life with HIV was possible. And I'm going to talk a lot about that, as well as the differences in their perspectives on patient autonomy and empowerment and the attribution of control in terms of end-of-life care decision making. Our data suggested notable differences in the way that HIV patients and providers understand end-of-life care. Patients commonly discussed adjunctive components of end-of-life care, such as living wills, rather than the process itself or their expectations of how end-of-life care would be enacted. This was despite repeated prompts for more specificity with respect to those issues. So, for example, when asked about whether they had ever talked to their doctor about the medical care they would want should they become ill, many responded by saying, "I have a living will," or "I have my wishes on paper." This woman said, "No, but I told my brother, it's like a living will that I'm going to make. I'm going to give it to my doctor. And then my doctor will sign it, and I'll sign it. It'll be notarized." You know what I'm saying? "Keep it, put it in my doctor's safe." Note that here she makes no connection about the contents of the will, nor does she make any connection between it and her specific wishes, should she become ill. Standing in contrast to the reference to living wills and powers of attorney, providers offered definitions of end-of-life care that were more medical in nature. They also, as you would expect, they also focused on the decision-making process in the context of end-of-life care. So, for example, a physician offered, "One definition of palliative care is keeping the patient comfortable at their end of life. If that's the point we're at. And the other definition is, when you're too sick to make decisions, healthcare decisions for yourself, who's going to do that for you?" Another provider defined end-of-life care as accompanying how patients want to die or how aggressive patients want to be with medical care as they get closer to their end of life. Thus, providers' accounts referenced medical intervention at the end of life, while patients referenced the paperwork that accompanies end-of-life care decision-making, rather than the specific interventions that might be considered throughout the process. Our questions about end-of-life care decision-making seem to elicit some ambivalence among both patients and providers. Some patients readily discussed concerns they had about death and dying. However, others had a hard time even considering the possibility of an eventual deterioration of death. That is to say, they simply could not see themselves as getting that sick, or they never thought it would get that serious to discuss end-of-life care issues. Understandably, some participants expressed fear about their futures. One participant said, "It was scary because I'm thinking long run type of thing. What would I do in the long run of this? Because if it was honestly left up to me, like I told them, let's just end this now because I don't know how I'm going to deal with this thing." In contrast to fatalism or resignation that some patients communicated about their futures with HIV, many providers discussed how important it was for them to communicate to their patients a message of hope. As an example of such a positive outlook, one male provider shared, "I mean, one of the things that's so cool about HIV is that people never run out of drug options. Well, there's about 3 or 4 new drugs in the next year and a half that are going to come out, including probably 2 new classes of drugs. So it's a field where there's constantly something to hold on to." Oops, am I off? Am I off? Am I off? Sorry. Okay. 5 minutes, thanks. Likewise, providers tended to be optimistic in terms of treatment options to manage the symptoms of HIV and stall disease progression. The same provider contended, "It's such a pathetic thing, you know, to say you're gonna die of HIV. Sure, if you have aggressive lymphoma and HIV, that's one thing. Dying of an infection, no one should die of an infection, you know, in my mind." Just as there was a disconnect between patients' beliefs about inevitable decline and providers' messages of hope, there was also a disconnect in terms of patient empowerment and the attribution of control with respect to disease progression and end-of-life care decision-making. Losing control was a salient theme, and anticipating such a loss of control portended fears of a bad death for some. So, for example, a female patient reflected on the care her mother received at the end of life, and she did not wish to suffer like her mom. "I said that if I have to have tubes, I don't want to suffer like that, you know, just let me go ahead and die. I don't want them to do nothing to try and keep me alive, because I've seen it with my mom. She wasn't able to remember that, but I'm just saying, I had seen it with my mom, and that wasn't, phew, tubes and all that. So don't make me suffer like that." Likewise, patients commonly express concerns about providers wanting to use more aggressive medical care than the patients themselves wanted. A male patient described how he wished patients could have more direct control over the decision of how and when to die. He said, "You should have the choice of being able to make that decision, that I just want to die. I mean, you should be able to say, well, the doctor could say, well, Gary, you know, you could push this button right here and it's over with. All you do, just push this button and you can prolong it. If I'm in a state where I can't use the bathroom, I can't feed, I can't eat, I can hardly talk, hardly breathe, I just want to push that button." So in contrast to the fear some patients had that they might be losing control of the process, when considering the actual provision of end-of-life care, providers tended to focus on a decision tree that would dictate the type of care they might consider implementing in any given situation. Most notably, their focus, both in the recounting of conversations they had with participants, as well as how they described their philosophy regarding end-of-life care, was squarely on quality of life issues. That is to say, providers demonstrated a thoughtful and non-aggressive approach to end-of-life care delivery. They emphasized the importance of educating patients on treatment options, planning for how children would be taken care of, and palliative care, including hospice. A male provider demonstrated how he talks with his patients about comfort and end-of-life care. He said, "My goals for your care would be to keep you with us as long as possible and to keep you as comfortable and as interactive as possible." A nurse suggested what might be the most salient issue surrounding them. "I think we always end up discussing and what people are most comforted by, that we will work to our best ability to relieve pain. People want to hear that." So to wrap this up, I want to draw some general conclusions. Our secondary comparative analysis revealed key themes and differences among patients and providers with respect to their perspectives on patient empowerment and attributions of control. On balance, we found that patients provided vague descriptions and focused on paperwork. And this to us suggests a lack of clarity in terms of what they would expect to happen. Unfortunately, those who provided more concrete examples gave more dreadful or fatalistic scenarios, often involving the unwarranted use of tubes to prolong life. The case of Terry Schiavo was going on during that time, and so that reference was made quite a bit during our interviews. In contrast, providers' descriptions focused on the process of delivering palliative care, and importantly, they focused on keeping patients comfortable and respecting their wishes at the end of life. So despite our patient participants engaging with us on the topic of end-of-life care, their responses suggest a degree of uncertainty and fear in terms of the medical management of dying. And I believe these issues could be addressed during conversations with our healthcare providers, who in this study at least seem to be really focused on patient empowerment and patient-driven palliative care. Whether the information we elicited during these interviews mirrors the nature of the information shared within the context of discussions between patients and providers is unclear. However, we suspect that patients don't have an adequate grasp of what that sort of care might look like. And we fear that the disconnect between patients' fears and concerns about advocating their rights at the end of life and providers' commitment to upholding their rights is causing patients to be less engaged in care. So I just want to spend my last minute or two talking about implications for practice and research. My implications for practice are probably pretty clear, but when we look at these issues, we're in our sample compared to other literature that I'm referencing there, our sample was more healthier in general and hadn't dealt with these issues. But at the same time, they had a lot of fear about what might be coming in their futures. And we argue that patients and providers have the responsibility really to initiate these discussions with their patients earlier and much more routinely in their care. We recommend that in terms of research, that we look at which approaches work best to bolster the patient-provider relationship, improve end-of-life care expectancy, and increase patient and informal supporter engagement and empowerment in healthcare. I believe one approach would be to interview patient-provider dyads about these issues, and I suspect that those interviews could actually serve as a sort of intervention in terms of gaining more understanding and, again, facilitating more patient engagement in care. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mozak.